All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you and good morning. I'm Judge Peach, and on my right is Judge Bartley. On my left is Judge Greenberg. We're here today in the matter of Willie J. Threat Jr., docket number 15-0835. Would counsel for the parties please make their appearances?
Your Honor, William Burke, for the appellant.
Your Honor, Anne Samansky, also for the appellant.
Your Honor, it's Jonathan Scruggs on behalf of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. With me at counsel's table is Deputy Chief Counsel Thomas Sully.
Thank you. The parties will be allowed 30 minutes each to present their arguments. Counsel for the appellant, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes, please.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any time.
Judge Peach, and may it please the court. The appellant, Willie J. Threat, asked the court to deem his March 4th, 2015, Notice of Appeal to the Board's February 20th, 2003 decision, timely filed under the doctrine of equitable tolling. Mr. Threat is entitled to equitable tolling on the basis of correspondence between him and the Secretary between March and August of 2003. The critical dates in that period are February 20th, when the Board mailed its decision, April 9th, when Mr. Threat's first written expression of disagreement arrived at the Board, April 22nd, when the board chairman wrote Mr. Threat back, and August 11th, when Mr. Threat's May letter, which was his misfiled notice of appeal, arrived at the regional office, which originated his claim.
Well, I hate to interrupt, but we might as well get the party started. The secretary starts out his response to your equitable tolling motion by saying that extraordinary circumstances aren't present here. And what's your response to that? What's the extraordinary circumstance? Do we need an extraordinary circumstance?
No, Your Honor, we don't need an extraordinary circumstance here because this is not an extraordinary circumstance case. In Bove versus Shinseki, this court clearly identified that there are three possible grounds for equitable tolling. First, extraordinary circumstances, such as when the veteran's severe mental illness prevents them from timely filing. Second, when the veteran detrimentally relies on an incorrect statement by the VA preventing him from timely misfiling. And third, when the veteran does timely file but misdirects the paper to the wrong office, so-called timely misfiling case. In fact, in Bove, this court examined four consolidated appeals, two of which were extraordinary circumstances cases, and two of which were timely misfiling cases.
And so your point is that this is a different breed than a breed of case than the kind that require ordinary extraordinary circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor. And for that reason, the extraordinary circumstances cases on which the Secretary relies are entirely inapposite, and all of the Secretary's extraordinary circumstances arguments are irrelevant to the question here.
Now, you seem to have a long gap period here, for lack of a better term, between when the 2003 filing was made and when the NOA was filed with this court, the filing in 2003 being made at the RO via the congressman. The secretary talks about the fact that, well, raises a few issues, as a matter of fact, with regard to this. But I think his main point is that you, or Mr. Threat, did not have due diligence, did not meet that requirement. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, my first response is that the clear precedent from the Federal Circuit, which this court's precedent is consistent with, shows that the timely misfiling of a notice of appeal at the regional office at which the veteran's claim originated satisfies the due diligence requirement of equitable tolling as a matter of law. In fact, in Jacquet v. Principi, the Federal Circuit explicitly held that once the veteran timely misfiles a document with that regional office, it's not necessary to examine the post-filing activities by the veteran. Furthermore, under Ratliff v. Shinseki, this court's analysis of the Secretary's M21-1MR policy shows that it was the Secretary's burden to act appropriately on Mr. Threet's misfiled NOA. And so that long timeline, that long gap, is really the Secretary's responsibility.
Well, okay, putting Ratliff aside for a minute, are you saying that that once there's a timely misfiling, any period could have passed, you know, 30 years, and it doesn't matter, the veteran didn't need to have followed up or taken any action, in fact, during that period after the timely misfiling?
Correct, Your Honor. The Secretary's argument that there's some undefined period of time after which a veteran can no longer assert the doctrine of equitable tolling in a timely misfiling case is essentially an argument for defensive latches to veterans' disability compensation claims, a defense which this Court has never recognized and which would be inconsistent with the Secretary's duty to assist, as well as both fundamentally unfair and unrealistic. Veterans have enough trouble assembling and understanding evidence to support their claims without being required to keep detailed records of their communications with the Secretary so that they might be able to prove due diligence years later.
In this case, Mr. Threet filed a letter or wrote to the congressman, and the congressman forwarded to the VA. In the other due diligence cases, wasn't the appellate filed his case directly on a timely misfiling? He filed directly with somebody in the VA. So the fact that we have a congressman who filed, how does that, if any way, affect the due diligence?
Your Honor, due diligence in the timely misfiling context is determined by the veteran causing the paper to be delivered to the VA during the pendency of the statutory 120-day period. Nothing in any of the cases refers to the means by which the veteran affects that delivery or the path which the paper takes en route to the VA. The fact that Mr. Threet here asked his congressman to forward his letters to the appropriate recipient does not deprive them of their validity. In fact, Mr. Threet's March letter, which arrived at the board during the initial 120-day period on April 9th, caused the board chairman to write him back directly, showing that the secretary recognized this as a valid means of communication.
Thank you. Well, getting back to your response earlier to my question, you were discussing Ratliff. Now, the manual provisions on which Ratliff was based, were those in effect in 2003?
Your Honor, the M21-1MR on which Ratliff was based was not in effect, but the M21-1, which contained very similar provisions, was in effect. In fact, in Jacquet in 2002, before the events of this case, the Federal Circuit expressly cited a very similar provision in the M21 to that which animated Ratliff. And it held, and I quote, citing the M21-1, it is not unreasonable for veterans to reasonably expect and rely on the VA to fully comply with the comprehensive policies adopted by the agency for the processing of incoming mail, including misdirected mail. And in fact, it was in the very next sentence of that opinion in which the Jacquet Court expressly held that it is not necessary to examine the post-filing activities of a veteran after such a timely misfiling.
Let me ask you this. In the record, we have, or I noticed a letter. It's on page 1420. And it's a letter from Mr. Threet saying to the Board of Veterans' Appeals, this is a letter to file a motion for reconsideration of the board's orders on the docket number that we're talking about. Do you know if Mr. Threet ever got a response to that letter?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to indicate that he ever got a response, and we do not know that Mr. Threed ever received a response. I do not think he did.
Would you consider that an indicator of a due diligence, perhaps post-filing?
Your Honor, I do. To the extent that the court holds that post-filing due diligence is required, this January 2004 letter indicates that Mr. Threed did not abandon his claim. Furthermore, his further pursuit of that claim throughout many years that followed showed that he did not abandon this claim, but rather relied on the VA's statements that the February 2003 decision was final. So his behavior in not appealing to the court or not raising that appeal was entirely understandable, especially considering that he was acting pro se throughout this period.
Keep going.
Yes, sir. The court asked, ordered the parties to address three questions here. The first, whether the timely misfiling of a notice of appeal satisfies due diligence as a matter of law. As we've discussed, the Federal Circuit in Jacquet expressly held that that is the case. And in Santana Venegas, the Federal Circuit expressly extended that bright line rule to timely misfiling cases involving notices of appeal. In Bailey Edward, the Federal Circuit made abundantly clear that this is a bright line rule that applies to all timely misfiling cases, where it held, quote, "We hold that, as a matter of law, a veteran who attempts to file a notice of appeal by completing a document that is clearly intended to serve as a notice of appeal, and who has that document delivered to the regional office from which the veteran's claim originated within the 120-day statutory period for appeal, is entitled to invoke the doctrine of equitable tolling." In Hunt versus Nicholson, this court held that after a Supreme Court decision in Henderson versus Shinseki, the Jacquet line of cases was restored to validity and remains good law. In both, as I mentioned, this court examined four different consolidated appeal cases, including two extraordinary circumstances cases and two timely misfiling cases. In analyzing whether equitable tolling applied in each of these cases, this court did a detailed factual analysis of the extraordinary circumstances cases to determine whether or not the veteran had shown due diligence. But in the two timely misfiling cases, the court simply held, I quote, "An NOA filed within the 120-day period at the RO warrants equitable tolling. It conducted no further analysis, apparently because none was necessary under the Federal Circuit's precedent." The Secretary asked, as I noted, for what is essentially a defense of latches, but does not give the court any particular period of time which he deems to be an appropriate time after which a veteran can raise the doctrine of equitable tolling, and provides no mechanism or standard for the court to determine when that's the case. So if the court were to adopt the Secretary's offered solution, it would be required to dive into the detailed factual circumstances, often ill-recorded, of each particular case to determine if, under those circumstances, equitable tolling was warranted. Furthermore,
what were the in Santana Venegas and Bailey? What were the time periods that we were dealing with there after the misfiling?
Your Honor, in Santana Venegas, the veteran timely misfiled his notice of appeal with the RO. The RO kept the notice of appeal for 70 days. So I'm not sure the exact number of days, but it was only a few weeks after the 120-day period expired. And Bailey Edward, it was approximately 10 months after the 120-day period expired. But, Your Honor, I'd submit that there is no specific timeline after which the equitable tolling can no longer be raised in a timely misfiling case. And that's specifically for the reason that the court's ability to determine when the statutory period under 7266 begins to run is based on its determination that it does not begin to run while the board's decision is abated by a misfiling. To fix a specific period after which a veteran can no longer raise equitable tolling would infringe to a certain extent on Congress's authority to establish a specific period. Your Honor, this takes me to the court's second question, the impact of Ratliff and the regulations discussed therein. The Secretary suggests that Ratliff does not apply because it was decided after this case. As I've noted, the Federal Circuit in 2002 referred to the M21-1, which was in effect prior to the events of this case. So the Ratliff Court's analysis of the M21-1MR, which this court noted had been in effect for, quote, many years at that time, really just recognized that the Secretary had long since assumed the duty of properly handling veterans' misdirected appellate documents. And under that analysis, this court held that when the Secretary is in receipt of such a document, the finality of the board decision is abated until the Secretary either forwards the document to the appropriate recipient, be it the board or the court, or the Secretary returns the document to the claimant with an explanation that it was misfiled and notification that a new 120-day period has begun. The Secretary refers to his August 12th letter to Representative Scott and notes that that letter contains the annotation, quote, VCC:DAV, to indicate that the letter was sent to Mr. Threet's DAV representatives. There's nothing in the record to show that that copy was actually sent, but regardless, it was not sent to Mr. Threet. And that is required both under Ratliff and the Secretary's statutory duty to notify in 38 U.S.C. Section 5103. Furthermore, that letter did not inform Mr. Threet that he had a new 120-day period in which to move for reconsideration or note an appeal to the court. Thus, that letter was insufficient to restart the running of the 120-day period. And just as in Ratliff, here, the board's decision from 2003 remains abated, and if the court recognizes that the May 30th letter that Mr. Threet sent, which the Secretary concedes was intended as a notice of appeal, was in fact a misfiled NOA, it can deem the March 4th, 2015 notice of appeal timely filed.
Well, I mean, this case is really a bit different from other misfiling cases in that here, I think in Jacquet and Santana Venegas and other cases like that, it seems as though the courts have assumed that the veteran made a mistake in where he or she filed. But in this case, the veteran, in his communications, specifically says this is where an NOA needs to be filed. Like, he doesn't seem to have been under any misconception as to location. He just didn't follow through with what he knew was what he knew needed to be done.
Your Honor, I'd argue that it's understandable that Mr. Threet chose to send his May 30th notice of appeal through his congressman, given that he had already successfully communicated with the Secretary via that same avenue the previous month. His March letter to the board was delivered to the board within just a couple of weeks. It arrived there on April 9th. A couple of weeks later, on April 22nd, he received a reply directly from the board chairman. So this avenue of communication was clearly open and functioning. It's completely understandable that Mr. Threet would send his next letter through the same avenue because he got such a quick response. In fact, in every one of Mr. Threet's letters, he shows that he was very exasperated with what he believed to be the Secretary's intransigence in not responding to his previous entreaties. Keep in mind that he filed this claim in October 1997, and we're talking about events 6 years later in 2003. And yet, the first time Mr. Threet sends letters through his congressman, he gets almost an immediate reply. So his May 30th notice of appeal, forwarded through his congressman, was really just an effort to attain a more notable return address. And yet, unfortunately, Representative Scott's office forwarded the letter to the RO instead of to the court, where, based on its content, it most likely would have been recognized for what it was, which is a misfiled notice of appeal. Furthermore, there is nothing to indicate in any of the authorities that having passed through the office of a congressman would invalidate a notice of appeal. Section 7266, this court's Rule 3, and all the Federal Circuit's precedent and this court's precedent on timely misfiling all focus on two questions. First, was the paper timely filed? And second, where was it delivered? None of these authorities focus on the path it takes, the means of delivery. If the court were to state that a congressman can't send on a veteran's notice of appeal, it opens up a whole host of other questions about who can. Is FedEx appropriate? Is UPS? Can a veteran give the notice of appeal to his roommate and ask him to hand deliver it? All these questions would become open and would have to be resolved. Furthermore, it's not consistent, that holding would not be consistent with the Federal Circuit's bright line rule, which focuses on the delivery of the document. As I noted in Bailey Edwards, the Federal Circuit explicitly stated that the veteran need only deliver the document to the RO. That occurred here. Mr. Threat asked his congressman to send it to the court. The congressman sent it to the RO and said, or actually gave it to the VA's Congressional Liaison Office, which then sent it to the RO. But the point is, the document was delivered, and that's the key fact. Furthermore, even if it was legally significant that the congressman forwarded it, there's significant authority to indicate that congressmen are authorized to advocate to the secretary on behalf of their constituents. 38 CFR section 3.155 provides that members of Congress can make informal claims on behalf of their individual constituents. The M21-1MR permits members of Congress to make benefits elections on behalf of their individual constituents. The rules of both houses of Congress permit members to advocate on behalf of their individual constituents to any federal agency. And in particular, the rules of the House, which are most relevant here, permit members to advocate for reconsideration of individual administrative decisions on behalf of their individual constituents. And tellingly, the Secretary's own Congressional Liaison Office makes a point of training all new members of Congress on their ability to advocate to the VA on behalf of their individual constituents in just this way. The act of forwarding the notice of appeal to the VA is no more intrusive or involved than any of these activities. In fact, it's quite less so. So there's no indication from any of the authorities that Representative Scott's act of forwarding this letter, as Mr. Threat asked him to, albeit to the wrong recipient, would in any way invalidate it as a notice of appeal. In conclusion, Mr. Threat sent a letter expressing disagreement with the board's decision, asking for reconsideration, that was delivered to the board within 120 days of the board's decision. The board chairman wrote him back on April 22nd, and Mr. Threat responded again with a letter that was delivered to the RO, which originated his claim, within the new 120-day period. Under Rossler, the first letter abated the finality of the board's decision. Also under Rossler, the board chairman's response renewed the finality of the board's decision and gave Mr. Threat a new 120 days in which to note his appeal or move for reconsideration. Because his May 30th letter arrived at the RO, which originated Mr. Threat's claim, within that renewed 120-day period, it was a timely misfiled notice of appeal entitling him to equitable tolling as a matter of law. Thank you.
And before you begin, could I ask you the question of whatever happened to that January 204 motion for reconsideration?
Yes, Your Honor. So it appears, you know, that document was submitted with a series of documents in January 2007. If you will look at the RBA page number 1412, Your Honor, the document you're referring to is at the end of that series of documents. So it appears that was submitted in a series of documents in 2007. In terms of what is unclear from looking at the preliminary record here is any response to that document there. But the Secretary would note that document was filed, or that document that you're referring to, Your Honor, is dated in January 2004, which is also beyond 120 days from the date of the board decision in this case. Judge Peach, Judge Bartley, Judge Ringberg, good morning, and may it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of the Secretary to assist the court in its determination as to whether the doctrine of equitable tolling is for application in this case. To aid in making this determination, the court presented the party with three questions. I will address each of those questions in turn and explain why it is the Secretary's assessment that the controlling case law, statute, rules, and regulations should lead the court to the conclusion that equitable tolling of the 120-day appeal period is not warranted in this case. With respect to the court's first question as to whether the due diligence requirement for equitable tolling is satisfied as a matter of law by the timely misfiling of an NOA, the Secretary acknowledges the Federal Circuit line of cases beginning with Santana Venegas that informs that a timely misfiling NOA does satisfy the due diligence requirement as a matter of law in those circumstances where the misfiled document was submitted to the RO where the claim originally was initiated or at the board. Nonetheless, those cases are not for application in this case because this case does not involve a timely misfiled NOA. According to Section 7266 of Chapter 38, timely means that a notice of appeal is filed with this court within 120 days of the date of the mailing of the board decision, which is February 20, 2003 in this case. As such, 120 days from that date was June 20, 2003. In this case, there is only one document that appellant has asserted in the pleadings that qualifies as an NOA, and only one document that meets the requirements for an NOA under the court's rules of practice and procedure. And that was the document dated May 30th, 2003, which was not submitted to VA until August 2003, which is outside the 120-day appeal period, as previously noted. As such, that being the only document in this case and the only document that appellant has pled is an NOA in this case, it cannot be considered that this case involves a timely misfiled NOA. As such, the Federal Circuit line of cases, beginning with Santana Venegas, is not controlling and is not for application. What does apply is this court's cases dealing with extraordinary circumstances in which an extraordinary circumstance must be shown, and as appellant has conceded, an extraordinary circumstance does not exist in this case.
Well, what about the intervening motion for recon, or what the veteran sent some materials to his congressman within the initial 120-day period, and that those materials were forwarded to the board by his congressman, and the board responded, I believe, to the veteran directly that that was not a motion for reconsideration?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the timely misfiled cases deal with the misfiling of an NOA. The March 2003 document being referred to does not meet the requirements as espoused in Rule 3 of the Court's Rules of Practice and Procedure as qualifying for a notice of appeal, as there is no intent in that document or expression of intent in that document seeking court review.
Yeah, but I don't, the appellant, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the appellant argues that that's the NOA. I think the appellant argues that that was a potential motion for recon, and that when the board responded, that began, because the board was acting on a potential motion for recon under Rossler or Ratliff, that would begin a new 120-day period.
I understand, Your Honor. So that would only be relevant if Ratliff was applicable to this case. Appellant's theory in that regard is totally based on Ratliff then for application in this case, which the Secretary contends it's not. As noted in our pleadings, the dispositive events in this case occurred 10 years prior to the decision in Ratliff, and appellant has not addressed how that is not relevant to this case, considering that there was no statement that Ratliff should apply retroactively.
Well, Ratliff applied itself retroactively to events prior to its decision. Because, I mean, I was going to say I'm assuming because, but actually I was on the Ratliff panel, so I don't have to say assuming because we applied it retroactively because the manual provision had been in existence prior. And you heard counsel's argument earlier, counsel for the appellant's argument that...
If I may, Your Honor, if I understand correctly, appellant conceded that the manual provisions referenced in Ratliff were not in effect at the time of the dispositive events in this case. And what appellant referenced was a separate manual provision in the Jack A case, which is factually distinguishable from this case because that involved a misfiling of a motion for reconsideration. But I think it's important that the manual provisions referenced in Ratliff are distinct. The manual provision in Jack A referenced what should happen to a misfiled document. The manual provision in the Ratliff case, which appellant concedes was not in effect at the time of this dispositive offense, deals with what should happen when there is a filing of a written expression of disagreement. And those are two distinct things, Your Honor. So I think it's important that that distinction is noted, such that the manual provisions not being in effect in this case, or in the Ratliff that were not in effect at the time of the dispositive events in this case, makes a difference such that, Ratliff cannot apply because those provisions were not in effect, and obviously the decision was 10 years later from the dispositive events in this case.
And so your position is that the rules were so different that it wouldn't cover this kind of situation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The manual provision referenced in Ratliff that, again, appellant concedes was not in effect speaks about what is to be done, what is VA's obligation when there is a written expression of disagreement. Because that was not in effect at the time of the dispositive facts, at the time this document was submitted to VA, what VA did in response, which was inform the veteran, if you will, with me, Your Honor, it would be RBA page 1485. That is the board chairman's April 2003 response to this correspondence to appellant. It in fact informs appellant that if you wish to file a motion for reconsideration, this is what you need to do. And also, if you wish to seek recourse in the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, here's the information that you need there to contact the court so that you can follow up as to the right procedures within the court. So implicit in that letter, and appellant and the documents filed with the court, concedes that VA did not view that March 2003 document as a motion for reconsideration by the fact of referring to what is needed for a motion for reconsideration in that letter. So, again, Your Honor, this case does not involve a timely misfiled NOA. In addressing the second question, Ratliff is not for application here because the manual provisions were not in place at the time of the dispositive events and because it was issued 10 years after. Even if we were to consider Ratliff as something that could be applied retroactively, as you referred to, Judge Bartley, the facts in this case are distinguished from the facts in Ratliff. Ratliff involved one document. The widow in that case submitted one document to VA that expressed, I would like to appeal. Under appellant's argument, appellant seeks to use multiple documents to apply the court's decision in Ratliff. That is very different. Also different in this case from the Ratliff decision is once the widow submitted the document in Ratliff, there was no action by VA. As previously noted here, once the March 2003 correspondence was received, VA responded with a letter informing the veteran as to the procedures for filing a motion for reconsideration and as to the procedures for contacting the court. So that is also very distinct from the Ratliff case. So the Ratliff case is not for application here, as it is distinguished from this case in multiple ways. As to the court's third question, as to accepting an NOA from an unauthorized party. The secretary does not deny that a congressman can forward documents. The secretary's point and the secretary's pleadings is that the congressman cannot file a document either at the court or at the VA with those on behalf of the veteran. So there's a distinction between forwarding or submitting a document that the veteran has submitted to the congressman to forward from the filing or the docketing of that actual document, if you will. So that is the distinction that the secretary would make.
And what does the secretary believe happened here?
So in this
case, weren't they just forwardings?
Yes, we can agree, Your Honor, that in this case, the congressman forwarded those documents to the RO, or to the RO, and to the board. Well, but relevant to the case law, Your Honor, in terms of those documents actually being filed, the secretary would like the distinction to be made and noted that there's a distinction between forwarding and filing of those documents.
You can't possibly be saying that VA or even the court could just ignore something that was forwarded by a unauthorized, to use your language, person.
Yes, not saying that at all, Your Honor. Absolutely not saying that.
Well, what is the distinction? I mean, I understand the distinction, like, I know the definitions of the words, but
right.
But it seems like you just said two different things. You said that the congressperson could forward something, but it can't be considered filed. And then I said, well, they couldn't, VA or whatever body we're talking about, couldn't ignore it, could they? And you said, no, they couldn't. Well, then, you know, essentially you're saying that whatever was forwarded would be de facto considered filed. Correct?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, and I will seek to clarify. I think we can look, you know, even in this case. So if we will follow the March 2003 document was sent to the congressman and then forwarded to the board chairman, certainly that document wasn't ignored. The VA responded, but nothing was considered filed. The same thing if the May 2003 document was forwarded to the court, certainly by the court's rules, the congressman is not a representative, while the court may then follow up with the appellant inquiring as to whether you're seeking to file a document. I do not believe that the court would then docket that correspondence just simply because it was forwarded by an unauthorized party. And that's the distinction the secretary is trying to make.
Let's stick with the board for a minute. You mm-hmm. said the board did not consider, nothing was filed. That was what you said about the board, nothing was filed. I mean, a communication was filed by the veteran, and the board responded that it didn't consider that communication a motion for recon. So...
And I guess the distinction that the secretary is trying to make is...
If he had filed what the board considered to be a legitimate motion for recon, mm-hmm. are you saying that because the envelope indicated it was forwarded by the veteran's congressman, that it wouldn't have been filed?
I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that at all, Your Honor. And I apologize for the confusion. Yes. In this case, specifically because this document is signed by the veteran, that it would be reaction in that way. The point I was trying to make is it wouldn't be a document then filed by the congressman. It would be a document that is filed by the veteran. I apologize for the confusion.
Okay, got it.
So, Your Honors, because this case does not involve the timely misfiling of an NOA, the Federal Circuit line of cases dealing with the timely misfiling of NOA are not for application in this case. Because the Ratliff decision is not for application in this case, given that the dispositive events here occurred over 10 years before that decision being issued, and the manual provisions that that decision is based on was not in effect at the time, as conceded by appellant, at the time of the dispositive events in this case, and because this case is factually distinct from the Ratliff case, that case is not for application here. As such, it is the Secretary's assessment that appellant has failed to meet his burden of showing that equitable tolling is warranted in this case. Therefore, the court should find that the 120-day appeal period should not be equitably tolled in this case.
Let me ask a question. If Ratliff doesn't apply and we go back in time to 2003-04, and Mr. Threet had a clear request for reconsideration, a motion for reconsideration, what would take me through the process of what the VA would have done?
If, and I just want to make sure I follow you, Your Honor, if there is a clear motion for reconsideration that was filed within the 120 days?
Yes.
In response?
Yes.
So the process presumably would be that the board chairman would have acted on that motion for reconsideration and either granted or denied that motion for reconsideration, and then the veteran would have had an additional 120 days from that point to decide whether he wanted to advance appeal with this court, or he could file a motion based on Q with that decision. But that would be the process, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
The Secretary's argument ignores the bedrock decision of this court in Rossler, in which the court expressly held that a veteran can file successive motions for reconsideration. Theoretically, reinstituting the 120-day period for an unlimited number of times. So the fact that Mr. Threet here relies on two documents is completely consistent with that court's decision, this court's decision in 1991. The March 5th letter arrived at the board on April 9th, less than 120 days after its decision, abating the finality of that decision under Rossler. Finality was renewed when the board chairman wrote Mr. Threet back in compliance with 38 U.S.C. 5103, which requires the secretary to notify both the claimant and his representative whenever it makes a determination regarding one of the veteran's claims. Less than 120 days later, Mr. Threet's May 30th NOA arrived at the RO. Now, the secretary makes a distinction between filing and delivery. That's a distinction without a difference. The RO doesn't docket anything. The RO constantly receives forwarded documents. These documents are forwarded by veteran service organizations, which may or may not be designated representative of the veteran on whose behalf they're forwarded. They're forwarded by members of Congress in accordance with 38 CFR section 3.155. So the fact that Mr. Threet's congressman forwarded his May 30th NOA to the RO is material only to the extent that it shows that that document was delivered during the renewed 120 day period and therefore was timely filed. Because filing has to do with delivery, has nothing to do with the courier, Mr. Threet's congressman's actions do not deprive that letter of its validity. The Secretary also attempts to distinguish Ratliff on the basis of the fact that this court's decision there referred to the M21-1 MR. But it's worth noting that in referring to the M21-1, the Jaquay Court specifically referred to that regulation's requirements for misdirected mail. There's no question that the letters here were misdirected, except for the March letter, which wound up at its intended destination. Mr. Threet repeatedly, clearly, and explicitly stated that he wanted his letter to go to the court. That shows that when it arrived at the RO, it was misdirected. So under the M21-1, the Secretary had assumed the duty of processing that letter appropriately, which would mean that the Secretary had the duty of either forwarding it to the court or returning it to Mr. Three with notification that he had a new 120 days. The Secretary did write a letter to Representative Scott and to the DAV on August 12th discussing the May 30th letter. However, the annotation BCC-DAV, to the extent it stands for the proposition that the Secretary sent the letter to the DAV, also stands for the proposition that the Secretary explicitly excluded Mr. Three from that communication in violation of the Secretary's duty to notify under 38 U.S.C. 5103. Therefore, that letter cannot possibly stand for cannot possibly satisfy Ratliff or the Secretary's duty under the M21-1. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the party to the parties for appearing today. We'll case will be submitted for a decision, and the session is now adjourned. We will come down to meet the council.
All rise.